are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hi, folks. Welcome to the show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Those of you who are joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. We're delighted to have you. And let me tell you, you're in great company. There's some great folks around this world tuned in right now, and now you're among them, and we're glad. You need to know, if you're a first-time listener, or if you're a first-time viewer, if you're viewing the show, that we have a free weekly e-zine, a free weekly newsletter. And all you have to do to subscribe is just get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. At my website, you will see, in red letters, you'll see K-Files e-zine. Subscribe to that. Just click on it and subscribe. And then you'll be in. There's no strings attached. You can unsubscribe anytime you desire to do so, although most folks stay with us forever. Got an email. In fact, I got several emails in response to what I said last evening about the thing with, you know, NASA and the tests they did that where they found who knows what. And but one email said, could you explain that thing about Mars and oxygen again? So here it is, folks. Several of the emails were about that, so let me do it very quickly. One of the experiments that they did with the Phoenix lander, the thing went out there, you know, and scooped up some soil, and they dumped it into the oven on board and baked it. You know, they run it up really, really hot, so it vaporizes it. And then the sensors sniff the gases coming off of that, off of the vapors, and they analyze it. Well, they got a big spike in their data, and it was so large that they thought, well, it was an error. It was a data glitch. So they ran another experiment. This one was the wet chemistry experiment. They don't heat it up. It's a wet chemistry experiment where they dissolve it. And so they put some more dirt into the lander, into the wet experiment bay, and it got a spike. And both of these experiments showed a big spike of oxygen. Well, of course, as you know, there ain't no oxygen on Mars. That's what they tell us. Well, they say it's like 1%. This is a spike now. The soil was oxygen rich. Well, they just couldn't buy that, and so they have told everybody it's perchlorate. Here's the problem, though. The problem is that when they baked it off, perchlorate, it's got chlorine in it. When they baked it off, the sensors didn't detect any chlorine in it, just oxygen. And the wet chemistry experiment, same results. So they're saying it's perchlorate. Maybe it is. I find that a little difficult to buy since there wasn't any chlorine in it. But that's the thing about Mars and oxygen, and we'll just have to wait and see what we hear next. My guest this evening is John Callahan, and we are going to have a great time talking about evidence, real evidence, for real UFOs. We'll be back. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steeline Media Network is supplied by the independent artist from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
Thousands of brave young men and women have returned no more. Many of whom have suffered devastating injuries and made a supreme sacrifice for our freedom. You can help these American heroes, and you really do hold the keys to change their future in your hands. Fans for Vet is a national organization that acquires new and used vehicles by donation, motorhomes, and sometimes even boats for placement with disabled and homeless veterans. We make necessary repairs to the vehicle. We go with handicap assistive hardware, driving controls, wheelchair ramps, and then we give these vehicles to the disabled veteran or the homeless veteran free of charge. You can change a life and show your appreciation by donating the vehicle that you no longer need to. Fansforvets.org. Please contact us at www.fansforvets.org. Thank you, and God bless America.
10, 9.
Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles in free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today.
Show unique in the galaxy.
My guest this evening is John Callahan, and we are truly privileged to have him with us. John was for 6 years the division chief of the Accidents and Investigations Branch of the FAA in Washington, D.C. And I think you probably, those of you who are familiar with him, and that would be a great many of you, are familiar with him because of his work and association with the Disclosure Project, where he talked about a very, very interesting and I would say important UFO incident. John, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thanks, Kevin.
John, explain to us, before we get into this really heavy, explain to us a little bit about this, what the Accident and Investigations Branch. What exactly does this branch of the FAA do? I know the name is very suggestive, but specifically, what does this branch do?
Well, I'll give you a little history. If you can remember back when they had the air traffic controller strike.
Yeah.
Reagan was the president, and he fired 11,000 plus or minus controllers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just prior to him firing all those controllers, I was the branch chief at the FAA Tech Center in charge of the software for air traffic. We produce a program every 6 months for 548 facilities in the United States. We were alerted that there might be a strike coming up in July or August of 81, I believe the year was. And at that time, my boss, the division chief, Bob Throne, he said that if this happens, how can we control traffic? So we developed a program so that if only one controller came to work in any one of these 548 facilities, under the software, the computer system, we could put the whole United States right on his scope, and as many airplanes as he could control, he would work, and we could keep the system moving. It was a great system. Now, during this time, when the controllers went out, we had all kinds of problems where some of the controllers were going in and destroying the backup tapes that we had the facilities make and put in the safe and all this kind of stuff. And my claim to fame during that time, I would get a call at late in the afternoon, and they would say that one tower needs his tapes. Get them there right now. And we would work with the military and fly the tapes out to the base, wherever it was that needed the tapes. As soon as the strike looked like it was over and they were recovering, bringing in military controllers and whatnot to take it over, the administrator at the time was Helms, Otis Helms, and he had asked at the at a meeting, there's nine division chiefs in headquarters and nine division chiefs out in the field. So he asked those guys, what type of quality control did the FAA exercise? Well, they had no quality control. But one of the division chiefs said, well, that's in the automation department, and that's Bob Throne. So he says to Bob Throne, well, what kind of quality control do we have? And he says, we have a quality control branch that handles the quality of the air traffic service across the country. And Helms said, well, who runs the quality control branch and where is it located? And Throne says, it's located here in headquarters, and the branch chief is John Callahan.
Is that the first you heard of it?
I didn't even hear it at that time. I got a call in the afternoon when he said, how would you like to become the second most powerful man in the FAA? And I said, who wouldn't want a job that had that kind of a title? He said, well, you got to get down here this afternoon because you're now the branch chief for the quality control branch. And there was no branch. It was me and one other guy became the branch. Now, eventually, after 81, it became a division. So we had five branches in headquarters and three branches out in the field. Well, in order to do our job, we ended up doing everything. We evaluated the facilities. We checked the controllers. If there was an accident, we had a team that would go out, and overnight they would find out what caused the accident. Is the FAA at fault? Is there something wrong with our procedures? And then how do we fix them? We would check the air traffic controllers to make sure that they weren't on drugs, that they had passed all this certification test, and that everything was okay. And we did all this within just a few hours. Within 24 hours, we knew everything. NTSB would find out everything we did, but it took them a year. And during that time that the NTSB would find out if the FAA was right or wrong, we could correct the problem very slowly so nobody knew that we were trying to hide anything. Well, this is what the division became. We were like the CIA or the Internal Affairs for the police department. And we looked at everything. Anything that was our policy was, anything that's going to become noteworthy or newsworthy or any major accidents, we had to find out as soon as it happened. And then we had to get a team of people out to that facility or to the site to find out what was going on. And because it may end up in court, we took no notes, we made no written reports, because anything you put on paper could be used against you later. So it was all like the cloak and dagger stuff, and it was very, very interesting.
Now, all right, now, let me ask a question that popped into my mind as you were describing this. You said anything that was going to become noteworthy, you had to know about it immediately. How, if you're not using any paperwork, how did they get that information to you?
Well, I'll give you an example. One day down in Atlanta Center, one evening, there was a little mix-up up there, and they ran two planes very close to Reagan as he was coming across the country, coming back to Washington. And we had what they call either a near miss or an operational error. And an operational error was where the controllers didn't have the proper separation between two airplanes, and they had to write it up. Well, because it was Reagan, if anybody looked out the window and saw someone else flying by, it would make the papers the next day. If the pilot had made any maneuvers to get out of the way of another airplane, then they would have complained, and it would have been in the papers the next day. So two or three minutes after this incident happened, the facility calls the region. The region calls the comm center in Washington. The comm center in Washington puts myself and five or six other guys on the line so that we all hear what's happening right then. And then our job on my side was to find out what really happened, who was controlling, what they did, what they said, how it happened, was the radar wrong, you know, where was the problem. And then at 6:30 in the morning, at the stand-up briefing with the administrator, we would say, this is what happened last night at this facility, and then we would give them a quick rundown on where they were. So if the reporters come in and caught them, then they would be able to answer any questions they come up with. They would have enough information to handle any kind of what are you going to do or what went wrong yesterday.
Okay.
We got all our stuff to the comm center.
Yeah, and briefing the guy at the top is a very, very crucial part of the operation. And I know that because I have some experience in that position running a unit that wasn't anything to do with aviation. It was international police, but I ran a unit where that's what we did. We gathered the information all night long. From after the briefing time in the morning until the next briefing in the next morning. And the main thing is the guy at the top doesn't want to be caught flat-footed in front of the press saying, I haven't heard about this. So it's very critical that they get the information. So does that mean...
Another example so you can see how we work. Came to work one morning, okay, and called into my boss's office, and he said Admiral Ingen, who replaced Helms as the administrator, when he was going home last night, they put a mic under his nose, and they said, is this system safe? Because we've got all kinds of problems. And he said, it is safer now than it ever was before. And I had said, how in the world could he say anything like that? Last week, they just had two mid-air collisions over California where bodies are falling out of the sky. We've got hundreds of operational errors with these new controllers coming in where normally we only had 20 or 30 a year. Now we're getting a couple of hundred a month. Serious errors. I said, who in the world could say this system is safer now than ever before? And the thing was, he said it, and your job is to prove him right. So you've got till 2 o'clock to come up with a press release that says the Admiral knew what he was talking about. And I called my team together and said, this is the problem, and they're saying, you're crazy. This system is scary. They're afraid to fly themselves. We've already had two mid-airs, and it don't matter. Our job is to come up and cover the Admiral's backside. By 1 o'clock, they had found 1 week in May this year that was better than a year ago in May. So we could write up something that says a random investigation, or worse that effect, shows that the traffic or air traffic is safer today than it was a year ago between May the 7th and May the 15th or some days like that. This is what we did for our living.
Don't you just love it when you're ordered to CHA, which means cover his assets?
Yes.
Yeah, I've been in that position, too. It's not fun.
If
all right.
You say, hey, it's not true, they say, well, tell me, you know, give me a name of somebody who can get it done.
All right. Now,
okay.
Does this mean that if there were UFO incidents, that they would be reported in this same way, and that you would brief your boss, the FAA chief.
Yes. Yes, yes. But now, here's the problem with the UFO, okay?
Yeah.
Normally, they're flying at a very fast speed. So with radar now, you'll get a hit, a strange hit. And so when the controller looks at his scope, or PVD they call it today, he would see a target that would show up as a bright, like a pencil eraser. And he would look at that for a moment, and then 10 seconds later, the system would refresh itself, and that target would move hundreds of miles in 10 seconds. So he would say, apparently it was nothing. And unless you were looking at a 500 or 1,000-mile scan, where you could say, over here I had a hit, and over here I had a hit, and over here I had a hit, and that there's something traveling along here, you wouldn't notice that. You would need someone up there flying along that said, hey, something just went by my nose, and it didn't look like an airplane, or it's an airplane that shouldn't have been there. And if it wasn't for that, the controllers wouldn't see them.
Are the controllers forbidden to make any statements about UFO incidents?
Well, that's one of those things they turn on and off. At one time, they would ask us to come up with anything that was out of the ordinary to report it. And then after a while, they said, we don't really do the UFO thing, so, you know, unless it's, you got two together or it causes a problem, then it's nothing. You know, you just roger the guy. If the pilot comes back and says, this is United so-and-so, and, you know, I just had a UFO out here, go by me. You would just, you know, roger, thank you, understand, and you go on your way, and that was the end of it. You did nothing with it.
What about public statements?
No, nobody makes public statements about that. Because
yeah, but is that an order that they're following or a policy that they're following?
Well, yeah, the only ones that can make a public statement are either the people in the region after they check with headquarters, Washington headquarters, to get the approval. They just don't go out and say anything. And that our philosophy at the time was we do not control UFOs, and so there's no statements about UFOs.
All right. You know, the thing that comes to my mind is you don't control enemy aircraft either, and yet if one were in our airspace, I think there would be a lot of press about it.
Yes, but in order for him to be in our airspace, we have to pick him up on radar. In order for us to pick him up on radar, so we have a new system now. A lot of people don't, when we talk about radar, prior to the strike, we used the old military radar that they had during the Second World War. And we had the IFF, Information Friendly, Friend or Foe. So you would see, you would have a large target, a primary target, and if he had a transponder on board, you would have a slash that came along with them. You could see the airplanes in the old broadband system because it showed everything that flew, even the raindrops and the clouds. It would show the clouds. Under our new system, you don't see that anymore. All you see is pluses or minuses, and you wouldn't recognize primary targets coming through the area. If we had a foreign government that wanted to fly into our airspace, if the military didn't pick them up as they were leaving Russia or wherever they're coming from, we wouldn't know. We wouldn't see them. Someone has to tell us that there's a strange aircraft up here in the sky floating by. We wouldn't know. You wouldn't know that target that you saw on the radar, the PVD today, was an enemy airplane unless somebody told you that.
So, okay, so but would it show up on the radar?
Yeah, it would show up as a dot.
But you don't know if it's a friend or foe. You don't know what it is.
We don't know if it's a truck on the highway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now,
and so whenever we hear, and we have heard some statements from air traffic controllers, that, for instance, in O'Hare, that they didn't see anything on their radar, are they telling us the truth?
Yes, they're telling you the truth because the radar isn't set up to catch it. you got to go one more step, okay?
Uh-huh.
Our system is broken up from like 18,000 and below or above 18,000. If you're flying below 18,000, a lot of times you can have your own little airplane, and you can have a little runway down the road. You can take off and go from here to Atlantic City without any air traffic control at all. You're flying VFR on your own. You're following the highway, and as long as you keep out of the restricted areas around D.C. and whatnot, nobody knows who you are. On radar, you show up as a dot, and they when they see the dot, they assume that's an airplane that's flying below 18,000, and he's flying on his own. If you were controlling an American airline, you would say to him, you have traffic at 1 o'clock, 9 miles. He's traveling northeastbound, and you'll be passing him in probably 20 or 30 seconds. That's all you would say. Altitude's unknown. He could be below you. He could be above you, but he can't be above 18,000. If he's above 18,000, he has to be under air traffic control's authority. He has to have a transponder, a working transponder that has a specified code, and now he's controlled. So you could have somebody flying through, and this is what, even when if you read the report from that Japanese guy, the controllers thought they had somebody flying along with the 747 that didn't have a transponder, and he was probably following the 747 to Alaska someplace. Because he was only a primary target. And the only way they knew he was there is because the pilot told them there was somebody out here. If they hadn't have said something, they wouldn't have known that there was anybody above 18,000.
Okay, we have to pause for a break. Got to do a little business. And when we come back from this break, I want to get into that incident that you just mentioned, and that's the Japan Airlines over Alaska. Fascinating incident, and this is the guy that knows the inside scoop on it. We'll be back right after this.
Shut up, this sounds sad.
This is the Kevin Smith Show. I am your host, Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is John Callahan.
John, when we went away for break, you had just mentioned this Japan Airlines flight. It was back in 1986, I believe, was it not?
Correct. Happened in November the 18th in 1986.
Tell us what happened. Not everyone is familiar with that.
Okay. Now remember I said that anything that happens that's newsworthy, our office should know right away.
Right.
So on November the 18th, the Japanese 747 had complained about having traffic. It wasn't until January, so we're talking like, 10 weeks later, that they called my office, the branch out in Alaska, and I got the call was, we need to talk to you right away. And when I got on the line, I said, what's the problem? I was too busy to get involved with, you know, petty stuff out there. And they said, we need to know what to tell the media about the UFO. My thing was, what UFO? Well, the UFO incident. I said, what incident? He said, well, it happened, you know, the other day is what he said. And I said, we didn't see anything about it. He said, well, you know, a 747 coming across our sky at 31,000 feet said he saw a UFO. And, you know, he says, but who believes in UFOs? I said, well, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. And then he goes on, he says, well, this guy was at 31,000. He said he had a UFO following him. And it was, well, for how long? He says, oh, 31 minutes. And you're calling me now. So I had said, tell the media it's under investigation and take everything you got. I want the voice tapes. I want the military tapes. I want all the radar discs sent to the FAA tech center overnight. Tomorrow morning, we'll go up and look at them and see what in the world you're talking about. Now, what had happened? When we went up there, we played it back and looked at it. We have a Japanese 747 that's flying along, I guess it was like 31,000 feet, on November the 18th. And he looks out his window, and he calls to the controller. It's midday out there in Alaska. He says, you have traffic for me. Now, the first time I heard that, you have traffic for me, was when I was a young controller back in the 50s, before radar. And the pilot says, you have traffic for me. And I said, no, we have no traffic for you. I'm looking at a bunch of strips. Well, because he said that and it was on tape, we had what they call a 304A department who would track down all these things. The fact that the pilot said he saw somebody meant that the separation was violated. And they tracked this guy all the way till they landed, and they spoke to him as soon as he got off the plane. Is he going to file a complaint against the FAA for having somebody at his altitude? Now, here's this Japanese pilot says, you have traffic for me. And that's that causes shivers on the controllers. And he looks at his scope, and he sees nothing there, and he says, negative. You have traffic. You know, what do you see? And he says, well, he says, I've got stuff over here in front of me. And it was like, well, what can you tell what type of aircraft is it? Can you give me a tail number, the altitude, anything like that? And the Japanese pilot's coming back and forth, and I guess, you know, I'm guessing he probably doesn't want to say it's a spaceship, but it's not an airplane. And eventually it comes out that he sees yellow and white strobes, and he looks at it that he has it on his radar. He sees it in front of him. It jumps over to one side of him. It goes behind him. And then apparently there's a couple ships that come out of the mothership or something, and they're just bouncing around looking at this guy. Now, while he's saying that, the controllers are looking at their scope, and all of a sudden, when the pilot says, the traffic is on my radar at 12 o'clock, well, in front of his target at 12 o'clock, the primary target shows up. That means he doesn't have a transponder. And that means he should be below 18,000 feet. But he's at 31,000 feet. So the controller right away says, well, it's to himself, it's probably a military guy. So they call the military over there. And the military says, no, we have no traffic there. But he says, let me check the rest of the people up here, and I'll get back with you. Then the controller says to the military, well, can you see this Japanese guy? He's on code 15-something, whatever it is. And he says, stand by, I'll check it. And he brings up his radar over in that area, and he says, yes. He says, I've got your Japanese 747 at 31,000 feet. He says, do you see any traffic around him? He thinks he has traffic at 12 o'clock. And the guy says, yeah, he has traffic at 11 o'clock in 8 miles, a big primary target. So the military sees it on their radar. The Japanese guy sees it on his radar. The Japanese guy sees him, and there's three guys in the cockpit, and they see him out when he gets closer. They see him out the window, they see him. The controller sees a target at a number of places all along the route of flight of this Japanese 747. And he changes his altitude. He starts off at 35,000, goes to 31,000. They give him a 360-degree turn, which takes forever to turn around. He covers half of Alaska making his turn. He drops down the altitude. The thing stays with him, to one side or the other, and it follows him as he goes across. The controllers ask him if he wanted to bring up the military to check him out. And the pilot says, no, negative. Apparently this guy isn't causing him any harm. He's just flying along with them. They're in a formation flight. And the controllers there weren't what you would call seasoned controllers, because one of the old guys that if they hadn't fired those 11,000,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't have asked the pilot if you want someone to check him out. He would have called the military. And if he had anybody flying locally, he would have said, put this guy on my frequency. I want him to go over here and check this guy and see if there's anybody around him that he can see. But they were waiting for the pilot to initiate it. And it goes on that the radar controller sees this target. The manual controller that's helping him, he sees the target. The guy working the handoff positions, he sees the target on the radar. The military people see the target. The pilot sees the target. Everybody sees this thing that shouldn't be there. But because it is not a Learjet or another airliner, it's a UFO, we have nothing to do with UFOs, and we don't believe in UFOs. So we have to say it's nothing. These other turkeys that we talk to, and I have a video. I took a video of the playback, so if you can see, you can look at the video, and you'll see the same target everybody else saw for 31 minutes as it's flying along. So there's a target there. Well, the FAA wants to kill it. So the FAA says there's nothing there. The FAA says it's a ghost target. They say it's a radar imperfection. It's split beacons. It's ring around. They have all these terms they use. Now, who can stand up and say you're crazy? That's not there, because you don't understand what ring around is, do you? Or a ghost target, or a bad radar return. So you just say, well, I guess it's nothing, because the FAA wouldn't lie to us. You know, this is the United States government. But everybody's seen this. If you were to go to court today and say that me and the Pope were walking down the street and we saw this guy come along and shoot the man next door, they would say, well, we have two witnesses that seen this happen, and as far as the law is concerned, that's enough. You've got two or more witnesses seen it, then the guy's got to really do something to say it ain't there. In this case, we have three pilots, you have like four air traffic controllers, you have the military controllers. They've all seen this target that is not there. And on radar, when we play it back on your TV, you'll see the same target that's not there, that everybody else saw, that isn't there. Now, when we get done looking at this at Atlantic City, I took a video of this playback. I have the voice tapes of the controllers, the pilots. I've got the printouts of everything they did. I had the experts there put a chart together that showed every hit on the radar or the system, and every aircraft or target that was around this guy for that 31 minutes. We brought that back to the DC. When I came back into the building thinking I'm going to go right home, the admiral heard I was in there, and he says, give me a 5-minute briefing. So I gave him a quick rundown on what we saw. He says, do you think you can put that video that you took on my TV? I said, I guess so. I never tried it before. We put that thing on there. He watched this for a few minutes, and he turned to one of his staffers and said, go tell Congressman and Senator so-and-so first to delay the meeting, and then he said, forget it. Tell him we'll reschedule for the next day. I'm going to see the rest of this. So we watched this tape for 31 minutes. And when he got all done, and he's a Navy man, he says, what do you guys think is there? Well, the blind man could see that there was something there. I thought it might initially be the stealth bomber. But he says, well, he says, I'm calling Reagan tonight, and we're going to hand this thing off to the president's scientific team. And he says, don't talk about it to anybody. I'll get back with you. Well, the next day, the CIA calls me. And you want to know about the UFO thing. And I'm saying, I don't know what you're talking about. You got to call the Admiral. Well, then the Admiral calls down and says, I set up a briefing for you to give to the President's staff and the CIA and whoever else they bring along with them. And he says, your job is to hand this off to them. When they leave here, they take this with them.
All right, we will continue with that right after this break. And this thing really gets weird, folks. We'll be back right after this. Kevin Smith here. Do you have your Kevin Smith Show t-shirt yet? No? Well, let today be the day you step into the world of galactic fashion. Visit the Kevin Smith Show online store and get yours today. Welcome back. My guest this evening is John Callahan. And
John, I had to interrupt you, but everyone has seen this. That's where what you were telling us. The Admiral has seen it, and he's going to hand it off now to the science team, the President's science group. Just pick up and run with the ball here.
Okay, the next day, I'm up in what we call the round room. It was the administrator's briefing room. And they came in with three guys from the scientific study team, three CIA guys, three FBI guys, and a handful of grunts. And we had printed out all the software printouts. If you remember back 20 years ago when they had those old computers that would print out reams and reams of paper to show what was going on.
Yeah.
Boxes and boxes of that. I played this thing on the TV for them. They watched it three times. Asked a bunch of questions. They wanted to know the range of the radar. They wanted to know the height finding equipment. They wanted to know the frequency. They wanted to know the speed. They wanted to know the algorithm for the height finding equipment. And I had all the experts up there with me, and they answered all those questions like it was, they were teaching high school, A plus B plus C squared equals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got all done, I got this. I was a little shorter than me. I call him the small CIA guy. He's standing next to me, and he steps forward, and he says to all the guys on the wall, he says, okay. He says, this event never happened. We were never here. We're confiscating all this data, and you're all sworn to secrecy. So I said, well, what do you think it is? He says, it's the UFO, and he says, look at these guys, they're drooling, they can't wait to get the hands on all this data. He says, this is the first time they've ever had this much radar data on a UFO. And the key word there was the first time, because I'm thinking, well, this is the first time they got radar data, they must have these other reports from before. But I had never really gotten involved in any of that. So they took all that data, they took everything that I had at the time. When I went down to my office a week or two later, I got the FAA's report, and I have that sitting on my lap right now. And when I went through that, I'll give you some more. After that, I got the tapes, the voice tapes, and then I got the printouts that I had the guys at the tech center made. Everything they did, they didn't know what to do with it, so they sent it to my office. I put it on the table waiting for the CIA to come back and get the rest of the data, and they never did. Now, here's what caught my eye as I'm reading this. And standing or sitting right here in front of me is the controller's report. This happened now. The date is November the 18th. On November the 19th, the very next day, he says, my name is such and such. I was working this position. And then he says, approximately 02250, we're monitoring Japan 1628 on sector 15 radar. He says the pilot came back and asked him if he had any traffic. And he says, no, I had no traffic. Do you want a higher or lower altitude? He says, I checked with the military, ROCC, to see if they had military traffic in the area and to see if they had a primary target in the area. ROCC did have primary target in the same position 1628 reported. Several times I had single primary returns with 1628 reported traffic. 1628 later requested a turn, and it goes on and on and on. Now, this was November the 19th, and everybody that was involved in this operation had to sit down and write what happened when they were there. What did they see, and what did they say? So everybody else should have had something in here dated November the 19th. On the next page in the report, it's dated January the 6th. And the same controller, who was the first guy we just read, he says he's employed. He says, during the period of 2030 on November the 18th, I was working. I'm making this statement to clarify certain points in my original statement of November the 19th. And he says, in paragraph 4, I stated in paragraph 4 that several times I had several primary returns with 1628 reported traffic. In actuality, I observed three types of targets. I saw tentative radar targets, which showed up as a minus sign or symbol. I saw plus symbols that indicate radar-only tracks. I also saw non-run length targets, which show up as a period symbol. Okay, now, to anybody else, that doesn't mean anything. You're probably thinking, yeah, I know what that means. But the thing is, this was January the 6th, and this happened, 10 weeks after the incident. Now, the next guy writes his, and he's writing his on January the 9th. Well, what happened to his report on November the 19th? We never got those. All the other guys wrote theirs on January 9th. And what happened is when they first did their report on November the 19th, the facility went over it and the region went over it and said, you can't say these things. You have to say it a little differently. And they pulled out all those November the 19th statements, but they missed one. It ended up in the report. But when you read the others, this other guy says, my name is such and such. He's employed. He says, I returned from my break at approximately 2:18 UTC to relieve this guy that was on the radar. In the process of relieving him, I heard the pilot of 1628 ask if he had any traffic near his position. I continued to monitor the position as the controller was too busy to give me a release briefing. I monitored the position for approximately 12 minutes, at which time I heard 1628 report the color of lights were white and yellow. After the radar scale was reduced to approximately 20 miles, I observed a radar return in the position the pilot had reported traffic. He says that. The next guy that was working with him on one of the other positions says the same thing. After he plugged in, he also saw a target, and he saw the same targets that the military saw. He called the military, the next guy says, and asked them if they had any traffic. And the military said, yes, they had traffic. They had what they called a double primary target, a very big primary target, in the same position that the 1628 said he had the target. So we have it on radar. We have it confirmed on radar by, like, six guys here. Plus the people and the pilots all have it, and we can look at it on the scope, on the video that I took, and see the same target. Now, the government doesn't control UFOs. It's not in any of our procedures to control UFOs. If it's a problem, it's a problem either with the CIA or the FBI. So they're the ones that have to check all this out and deal with it. Not the FAA. They don't know what to do with the UFO.
Okay.
They travel at high speeds, at high altitudes, and that we don't even know whether they're there when they're there, unless somebody says there's somebody here.
Now, you described something that I have mentioned before on this show. In one of my former positions, I was sitting at the top of a great number of people, and reports from the ground would start flowing upward each and every day, and within a 24-hour period, I would get what was called a SITREP, a situation report. And what's happened is that at each level, and I've described this, at each level where that information is flowing up, people at that level will whitewash anything out of it that may seem to be embarrassing to them at their level. And then it gets passed up to the next level, so that by the time this information gets to the guy at the top, it's almost completely useless. It's a complete whitewash. And I've always said, if you really, really want to know what's going on, you ask the guy on the ground. If you really want to know what's going on, it's the foot soldiers that know. It's the people that everyone says is at the bottom of the food chain. They're the ones who really know what's going on. And you described that happening with this report, where they said, oh, you can't put those kind of terms, you can't use that kind of language in these reports, and they pulled them. That's why it never got to you.
True. Not only that, but at one time, just before the strike happened, my task was to find out how it is, what's the feeling out in the field. So I sent three guys out to New York Center, to Chicago Center, I think the other one was Atlanta Center, with a ruler, and their job was to measure the aircraft being handed off, the spacing between aircraft as they're being handed off from one facility to the other, to make sure that everybody is adhering to the restrictions. So they're at one of the radar scopes with this ruler, and you're supposed to have 20 miles between them, and sometimes you have 20 and sometimes you wouldn't. Well, the controllers are saying, well, this is pretty good. They put these restrictions out. Now they got guys here checking to make sure that that other facility, which never does right, is going to do right. But they, what they were doing was just meeting the controllers on the position. And then at night, after work, they would go to the local bars where sometimes the controllers worked as bartenders after hours, or they just hung out after hours, and they would sit there and have a drink with these guys. And they would talk about what's going on in the facility and the, you know, the restrictions and this kind of stuff. And after the second day, they would call up and say, there's going to be a strike on August the 3rd. They've got buttons. They've got this. They're meeting here. They're doing this stuff. They've got the you know, flyers out. They've got the big organization going, and you better be prepared because it's going to come. But we found all that out thinking, and they're thinking we're measuring the restrictions between the airplanes. And we did a lot of that stuff.
Now, whenever these incidents would happen, I mean, in the 6 years you were there, this could not have been the only UFO incident that you were involved with.
No, it was. It was the only one.
The only one in 6 years.
The only one, yep. The only one that made the... See, in order to have, you know, an incident, okay, you need a pilot to look out the window and say, you know, there's somebody flying off my left. And it could be, you know, a Learjet. Usually in the old days, when they put that restriction in, if you want to go above 18,000, you need a transponder. Well, the transponder would go out for one reason or another when they took off. And now they had a choice. They could either stay at the low altitude and burn up a lot of fuel. They could go back and land and have the thing fixed. Or if it was a nice day and you could see forever, they could follow this 727 or 737 that's going in the same direction. They just shoot up and they get underneath him 1,000 or so feet, and they would just follow this guy across the country. Well, every now and then the air traffic would slow that guy down that they're following because they're arranging for speed control and spacing at the airport. And when they slowed him down, this other guy would go drifting by because, you know, he's not slowing down. He wants to get there and get down. Well, then the pilot would look out the window and say, you know, I've got this Learjet that's passing me here, and, you know, he's closer than he should be. Up here, I'm supposed to have 2,000 feet between these guys vertically and, you know, 3 to 5 miles, and this guy is just off my left and just below me. Well, they would look at the radar, and they would see a target there, a primary target, and then they would track him, and they would call flight standards and say, we're tracking this guy, and it looks like he's going to L.A. or Vegas or someplace, and they would watch him as he went down and landed. And when he rolled off the runway, they would have flight standards. They're like the police waiting for him, and then they would write him up for flying in an airspace and for not having the proper equipment. But you needed someone to tell you that there was somebody here. Now, the pilots, some of the pilots would fill out those UFO reports and send them to a UFO center. I forgot what the title of it is now, but they could send it to them, and they wouldn't have to sign it, or they wouldn't use the name or whatnot, so that they could say, this is what happened, and it was an unsafe situation. But they wouldn't go through the FAA channel.
All right, we have to take a break, John. And folks, when we come back, go ahead, and you got a few minutes here, get you a cup of coffee or a Coca-Cola, and when we come back, be ready to start calling. The telephone number, 623-581-5148. And you can ask your questions or make your comments as you talk with John Callahan. We'll be back right after this. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
Get it all. Become a member at KevinSmithShow.com.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. The telephone number, if you wish to call in, is 1-623-581-5148. Let's keep it to one call per individual this evening. 623-581-5148. We want everyone to get a chance to get in.
John, we've got callers on hold, so let's go straight to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Eric from Atlanta.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, John. My question, I'll make it quick, is does the name Ron Pandolfi ring a bell to you?
John, were you able to hear that?
Yeah, he's very weak, but Well, the name's familiar, but I can't picture who, what it is, you know.
Okay, and has Bruce McAbee by chance had a chance to analyze the data you have, and do you have any plans on kind of like, has anyone asked you if you could make that information public that you still have?
Well, I think the information is public. It's, we, you know, we went to Congress with the with Stephen Greer's group, and I've been on a bunch of other shows, Discovery and whatnot, and we brought all that out. They also had the, they come in and took the video and looked at all that stuff.
Is the data on like a website that's available for the public or not?
Yeah, I think you can get it. If you go to just Google Callahan and UFOs, and you get the, you can see the stuff they have on video.
Okay, thanks a lot, John.
Thank you for the call. John, this this meeting where you briefed the president's science team after the meeting concluded, or at the conclusion of the meeting, the you said the CIA guy said, okay, this meeting never happened, this incident didn't happen, and you're all sworn to secrecy. Did you have to sign any kind of a secrecy oath at that point?
No, didn't do anything like that.
Did you raise your hand and say, I swear to secrecy?
No, matter of fact, the way we were standing, it looked like he was talking to all the people we had brought up in the room, and I had 12, 14, 18, I don't know how many people I had there. I had all the experts from the hardware and software department, and as far as I was concerned, he was talking to them. And what I said to him when he got done, I said, well, you really think it was a UFO? And he says, yes. So I said, well, let's send a Twix out, put a Twix out to tell the public that we've been visited by, you know, someone from another planet. He says, oh, no, we can't do that. I said, yes, we can, because we're always sending Twixes out that says the system's safe, don't worry about it, and all this kind of stuff. We do this all the time to send the Twix out. And he says, no, we can't. If we tell the American public that we've been visited by, you know, aliens or something from another planet, he says that they would panic, and we can't tell them this. They can't handle it. And I had said, well, you know, my job was to hand this off to you. What you do with it now is your concern, not mine. Me, I would have sent a Twix out and said, you know, this is what happened. But he says, no, we can't do that.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Ah, very good. When you call, folks, and your telephone stops ringing in your ear, that's your first clue I've put you on hold. Your second clue is you can hear the show in your telephone. Please stay there if I put you on hold. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, Kevin. This is Steve in Texas.
Hi, Steve.
Oh, how you doing? John, I wanted to ask you a question. I've been wanting to ask this question for many years, but post 9/11, they had grounded all the commercial aircraft from the skies, and it just so happened that I personally saw the best UFO sighting that I've ever seen in my whole life during that time. And I was curious if there was any radar anomalies noted specifically in that time frame. And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for the call, Steve.
Well, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know. I don't know how to answer that question and say that. I wouldn't know. Until I got involved and met some of these people that have been more involved with the UFOs, you know, the ones that have actually seen them and touched them and took some videos of them, I just seen what the pilots saw on radar. And apparently, they never had this much radar before, recorded data, that you could see what the controllers was actually looking at. So when you look at what I have, you would say, well, there's a target there. And then you would say, what is it? And you would have to ask the pilot flying along to tell you what was there. But as far as all the other reports and stuff they had, I mean, we've got astronauts that'll tell you that. You know, they're a flight of two sometimes when they're out there flying around our own universe. But what the FAA does with the radar and how they see it, I can't tell you anymore.
Okay, and that would be because you're not affiliated with that anymore, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, now along with that, concomitant with that statement you just made, there is I have a flash message from one of our listeners in the UK that says, do the airports in the USA have UFO reporting forms? For example, if someone phoned in to the airport to report something odd that they had seen, would the airport have a report form that can be completed over the phone from the observer? And the reason he asked, and I'll shorten this, the reason he asked is because they do in the UK, and then the Ministry of Defense, it says 2 weeks after he received, or 2 weeks later, he received a letter from the Ministry of Defense stating there was nothing in the area at the specific time of his sighting. So, of course, you know, you expect that's going to happen. You didn't see what you saw.
Yeah.
But at least there is a form in the UK where they take the report and forward it to the Ministry of Defense. What about in the USA? Do we have anything like that?
Well, at one time they did, and they dropped it. It was one of those where they bring it up and then they get rid of it after a while. The last I knew that it was gone. But if it happened today, I'm guessing, if they called the control tower, they would turn them over to either flight standards or the flight service station people and have them report it, and then they would send that report to some place, either a NASA outfit or another group. That they really wouldn't do much with it other than just forward it.
All right. Now, I'm aware of an incident that took place in 1992. I've talked about it many times on this show. Because of the fact that it involved the police agency that I was attached to when I was doing law enforcement in the United States. It was a sheriff's department. But I don't want to get into the whole thing, but it was a massive UFO. It was gigantic. At one point, the deputy calls in on the radio to headquarters and asks them to call the airport and talk with the people in the tower and ask them if they see anything on their radar. The headquarters reports back in a few minutes that they've talked with the tower, and the tower says they don't have anything in the air. The deputy said, and I have all this on tape, the deputy says, headquarters, you're telling me that the air traffic controllers say they have nothing in the air? I'm looking at five planes up here right now. How is that possible?
Well, it depends on how they interpreted your question. They might have said, I'm not, they might have answered it as if to say, I am not controlling anything right now in the air. And if he doesn't have somebody under his control, then he really don't care who's flying around out there on radar, because it could be below his airspace or above his airspace, and he's not interested in it. Plus, under the new system that we have, every airplane is tracked by the computer, and every airplane has to have a number for the computer to track it. If you remember back prior to the strike, we had what we called Black Thursday here in the United States, where we had just sent out the first automated system. Everybody's on automation now. And then Washington Center started to slow down. And then New York Center started to slow down. And then Chicago Center started to slow down. And then the computer system just died. And we backed traffic up into Europe. It was a day to get all the traffic moving with the automation system. They had set on Thanksgiving Day, I had to call in a SWAT team up at the tech center to find out what the problem was with the computer system and to fix it. And what they come up with at the end of the day was there's too much data for the computer to put out on the scope. So in order to do that, we have to create two lines coming in from the digitizer. And one of them will be the radar data, and the other one will be the weather data. So this way here, you can shut off the weather data and just let the radar data come through, and it'll help the computer do its job. Because if it runs out of time to put everything on the scope, it doesn't know what to do with the data, and it just clogs down. Well, when we went to those two lines,
They also said to make the system run faster, we won't record everything on the weather data. And then they come up with a real brilliant idea. They said, you know, the radar system and the computer, when they work together, the computer is smart enough to count every time the radar hits an airplane. And they have a real thing they come up with, a table that said, we can give each airplane out there a run length that we know if it's 137 hits, it's a Cessna, and if it's 500 hits, it's a 747 or something like this. And we can put all that data in a run length table, and we can tell the computer to, when it hits a 747, check and see if it's on the right code, then check and see if you get the same hits in the run length. And if you do, then this is quality control. We know this is who it is. If you have too many hits on that one airplane, then it must not be an airplane. It must be weather. And if it's weather, of course, it's going to go through the weather line. And you don't have to display it unless the controller wants to see it. So what we actually did on the new computer system is we said if that aircraft is too big, so the computer thinks it's a cloud, a rain cloud, then it will not display it for the controller to see. And that's what's happening even today. That's the same system they're working on today, and nobody knows that.
So the system is actually designed to not show UFOs if they are big.
That's correct. And it's designed not to show everything that is in this guy's airspace unless it's physically in his airspace and he's going to control it, or he needs to know it's there to separate it from other airplanes. So a lot of times, I can be working the sector next to you, and I can say, hey, I'm going to cut through the northwest corner of your airspace at 29,000, and you may see a single slash going through there, and the guy will say, yeah, that's fine, go ahead. I got nobody in that area. Well, he doesn't know who it is or what it is. If he wants to know, he's got to go into the computer and say to the computer, tell me who this guy is, and they put a little data block up in there. But most of the time, we used to call it a point out. We're just taking this guy through your airspace. Keep away from him. Well, he only sees today what he has to separate airplanes from. And whether it's a good system or bad system, it's hard to tell because it's supposed to be the best air traffic system in the world. But that's the way it works.
Well, I tell you, you have enlightened us to something that I bet most did not. I certainly did not know, and I've done a ton of flying, but I had absolutely no idea that it was separating data like that and just hiding some of the data from the air traffic controller. This UFO that Japan Airlines saw, they had visual contact as well as radar. The crew. As big as four aircraft carriers.
Yep. And the speed of travel that is unbelievable. I mean, it's something we just can't comprehend. It's just unbelievable. But now, when you talk to these head shrinkers that say it's impossible to go from one planet to another planet to come here, mm-hmm. why would anybody that could, if they could do that, come here to Earth? Because we're so young that one guy compared us to the goldfish, and what would the people have to do with the goldfish in the pond? How can you make his life better? The only thing you could use him for would be for food, if you wanted food. And he says if people could come here, they would look at us like we were the goldfish because we're so far advanced. And the other problem is, if they do travel from one space or one planet to another, they're not using fuel like we are. They don't have gas, and they don't stop along and refuel at the moon or someplace. They're not running on gas. They're not using gasoline and oil. And that's another problem that we have. If these ships can go from one place to the other and they can go without using the same type of fuel we have, that means they're really advanced from us. And if we could get that technology, we wouldn't have to worry about the oil crisis we have today. So there's a lot of people that don't want you to know too much about what's happening out there.
All right, let's talk about that for a minute. You were told all of you guys were told at the end of that meeting back in 1987, huh?
Mm-hmm.
By the time the meeting took place.
Yep.
So you were told this meeting never happened, and all of you, you're all sworn to secrecy.
Correct.
Have there been any repercussions, or have you received any pressure whatsoever since you started talking about this?
No, they just ignore it. The FAA ignores it because it's not in their rifle, and they don't control UFOs, so they ignore it. The CIA said it never happened. So what can they say now if they said it never happened and they were never there? I think it's the hoping that, you know, I'll die and it'll go away, and that'll be the end of it. But nobody's done anything or said anything. They just ignore it.
All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Ryan in Washington.
Yeah, Ryan.
Hey, Kevin, do you think there's people high up in the government that might be listening right now?
Oh, it would not surprise me.
Well, if there's anybody that's in the government that is high up in the government, just listen to how much of a safety hazard this is. Just listen to how much of a public hazard this is to have these things going on. And I'll just take that off the air.
All right, thanks. Well, what about that, John? Is it did this incident, did it pose a safety hazard for the airline?
Well, it could. If so these guys are just out sightseeing and they drop down into the airspace that we're operating in, yeah, it could be a problem. But it's one of these where we don't control UFOs. We don't control, the enemy airplanes that come in if they decide to fly in our airspace. We don't. The FAA don't control that. It would either be the military or the CIA or the FBI that would have to deal with these invaders or intruders, whatever term you want to use, but not the FAA. We just control known aircraft. Our job is to keep known aircraft separated from other known aircraft, not the unknown. So right now, their hands are tied. I don't know how they would do it. It'd be the same as asking you to tell them how to control this situation. You're going to say, I don't know how to control this situation. Tell them not to fly here.
I'll tell you what they could do. What they could do is unblock that situation where the large radar returns are assumed to be weather, and show it to the air traffic controller and make reports on that and make it public. That's what they could do.
Yeah, but that would scare a lot of people. If you knew some of the stuff that I know about how the system works, you'd probably be taking a train from now on when you go from one place to the other. Don't tell them shit. We did a lot of funny things in the beginning in air traffic. We took on the... I started air traffic using paper strips to control airplanes with. And then we went from paper strips. We had a frequency so we could talk directly to the pilot. And that was a big jump. And then a year or so later, they went where they brought radar in. And a few of the sectors would have radar. And it would just be... You could just see little blue targets flying along on the airway. And to find out who the guy is, you would tell him, American 87, make a right turn for 30 degrees for 30 seconds and then resume your own navigation. And then you would stop looking for someone that looked like he was making a turn. And sometimes you would have five or six guys making the turn. And you would keep on going until finally you said, well, this must be him. But we were talking about just a little speck for a target. And then they brought in automation, and automation was a godsend. But what it does, it's great. It'll tell you what the guy's altitude is in hundreds of feet as he takes off from the ground. It tells you how fast he's going. It'll tell you where he'll be in 2 minutes. It'll run lines out and say, in 2 minutes, he's going to run together with this airplane unless you do something. And these are great strides, but it doesn't show you everything. And what it does show you is also delayed. You're controlling traffic from where they were 10 or 20 seconds ago. Now, you may say, well, what's 10 or 20 seconds? Well, if you watched the Olympics the other day, Phelps beat his record by 1 second, and the guys behind him, 1 second behind him, was, what, 10, 15 feet. So 20 seconds, you're traveling at 600 miles an hour, and 20 seconds, you're telling this guy to make a turn based on where he was, not where he is right now, and most of the people don't even know that. That's controlling traffic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got to be a hairy kind of a situation. Whenever these guys, Japan Airlines, whenever they reported this UFO, they really were pretty much breaking with the tradition of silence, weren't they?
Sure, not only that, but they got fired. When they went to when they finally landed in Japan, they lost their job because they embarrassed the Japanese nation by saying they saw a UFO. It was a taboo.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one of those guys from Stephen Greer, used to work with NASA, Hines his name was. He had called the Japanese government and convinced them that these guys did see what they've seen, and that there's nothing wrong with them, and that they shouldn't be penalized by losing their job. So they were given their positions back, put back on flying status, but with restrictions. So when you talk to them, they can't talk to you, because if they do, they lose their job.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And welcome back. It's the Kevin Smith Show. I am your host, Kevin Smith. My guest is John Callahan.
Now, John, we were talking about these guys, these pilots getting fired. Does that happen in the USA as well?
Well, if you talk to the pilots, many of them will get not so much reprimand, it's just that they don't talk about those type of things. And that you don't put it down in writing. If you want to call in, that's why I think that NASA group come out with, I forget what the form it was, that said if you run into a problem and you're afraid to turn it in, fill it out and send it to us and we'll keep track of it. And it could be anything. Problems on the runway where they ran their two planes together and never got reported, they would send it in to them. We would compare those notes with the errors that we had collected every day. And sometimes there was a big discrepancy between the two.
Well, and that actually could be really vital information. I mean, even just debris on a runway. The thing that comes to my mind is that horrific accident with the Concorde. And I think they said it was due to some debris on the runway.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if debris on the runway can cost the lives of all the people on the Concorde, I think it was all of them, and totally destroy that supersonic work of art. It was just a beautiful airplane. One can only imagine the dangers that a UFO could pose, and yet we don't know of any commercial aircraft that have ever collided with them, do we?
No. And it's not so much collided. If they get too close and they pull away too fast, then it's just like one of those 18-wheelers on the highway. When he goes by you, depending on what you're driving, you know, it'll like move your automobile toward him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You could have the same problem up at flight levels. If one of these guys got too close and was traveling too fast, he could suck you along with them for a while. The wake turbulence. But for some reason or other, we really, well, as far as we know, you know, we haven't had that problem. Some of these guys that maybe fall out of the sky or they crash, we don't know about it, could be related to this, but we'll never know because we don't know that.
Are you saying that it is possible that some of the mysterious crashes, just speculation, hypothetically, could have been caused by UFOs?
Sure. Sure. I mean, it could be anything, yeah. Sure.
Down in Mexico, around the airport there, around Mexico, in Mexico City, they have had lots and lots and lots and lots of UFO sightings around that airport. And yet, as far as we know, there have been no collisions. Do you know anything about that Mexican air situation?
Well, just when I talked to some of the controllers, I met the tower chief one time, I think when I was at Mary Washington University. I had met him and talked to some of the news people that record that stuff, and I seen some of their videos. And it's like watching a science fiction movie when you see what you know we would call a flying saucer. You'll see two or three of them just coming above the runways and just going over the top of the control tower and doing their thing. And it's like a regular occurrence down there. But of course, our country says that doesn't happen. And I go by that little phrase that says, who are you going to believe, your lying eyes or the United States government?
Oh, my goodness. And that is actually an excellent question, isn't it? Who are you going to believe? You know, one of the things, John, I mean, you're obviously an expert witness. There's no question about that. You are an expert witness, and you've got the bona fides, you've got the credentials to prove that you're an expert witness. However, one of the things that happens a lot to we'll say Ma and Pa America, just the average person out here, is they hear someone say about, they'll hear a UFO report and they'll hear some skeptic say, well, yeah, but you know, he's not a trained observer. And you know, one of the things that I've always said about this, I am a trained observer. And I, as a trained observer, I say this. You may not be a trained observer, but you have had eyes all your life. And you know when what you're looking at is not an airplane. You may not know what it is, but you know if it's not an airplane. And I think that when people say they saw something, they should be taken seriously.
Especially if it's more than one. I mean, if only one guy says it, I can say, well, how come someone else didn't see it? But if you've got two or more people say, this is what we've seen, and they all come up with the same thing, I don't know how they can turn it down. Again, if you had seen somebody robbing a store or killing somebody, you and the guy next to you, that's all you need in court, two or more people, witnesses, and unless they can prove these guys are blind, then that's it. But our country, they believe the government, okay? Now, how many of those guys they believe? And, you know, we're going to tell the truth, but we also work for people who don't tell the truth. And the people we work for say, you know, you'll tell them this and make it convincing.
Mm-hmm.
We had an incident down in Miami where a controller messed up and flew this one guy through three or four other airplanes, and they were going to file the criminal charges against him. And it came through Congress, the complaint. I sent the man down there to investigate. He's down there for 2 days. He calls back and he says, everything looks okay. It was a sloppy operation. I've talked to 11 controllers, and they all said the same thing, and I want to come home. And I said, well, it's like 7 o'clock at night. I said, go back and talk to the third guy again that you interviewed. He says, the third guy? I said, you go back to him and tell him that there's something wrong with what he said because it doesn't jive with all the rest of the people. He says, well, that's not true. They all said the same thing. I said, well, he can't say the same thing because it doesn't work that way. Go back and tell him that. And if he still says the same thing, you can come home. He called me at 2 o'clock in the morning. He says, well, I finally finished. He said, I brought that third guy in, and I told him what you said. And he starts to cry. And I'm thinking, what in the wrong is wrong with this guy? And he says, I knew those other controllers were going to blame me. And he says, it wasn't my fault. It was so-and-so's fault. And then he came up with the whole story. And it turned out that the facility was trying to cover up what had happened because it was so bad, the chief was afraid he was going to lose his job, which he did. But this is what they do. And yet we have people walking across this country that says the government would not lie to us. If they tell us something, that's the way it is. And when I show them the video I have right here and they listen to the tapes, they can't believe that the government doesn't say, that's a strange craft. The pilot says it's a UFO. Why would we think that he's not telling the truth? And it just blocks the mind. But that's, our government says the American people cannot handle the truth. We can't.
And I think that's true of some, but certainly not all, and I think probably not the majority. All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
How are you, Kevin?
Good.
This is Tony in Norman, Oklahoma.
Yes, Tony.
How are you?
Good.
Haven't talked to you in a while.
Mm-hmm. What's on your mind?
John, good to have you on. Appreciate it. I just have one comment. In Mexico, there was at least one, I think it was a 727 coming into Mexico City, and the landing gear hit a UFO.
I had not heard that. Had you, John?
No, I haven't heard that either, no. But it doesn't mean it didn't happen. It's just that I haven't heard it.
Yeah, that's the first I've heard of it. When did this happen?
Oh, I don't know the year, but it was on one of the, I can't even remember what show it was on, but it was on one of the old Discovery Travel Channel, just one of those UFO things. But it was all about the Mexican sightings and had to do with Mexican air traffic control. and one air traffic controller had the 727, and the pilot reported a UFO and then a collision. And the pilot thought that he had hit the UFO, and on landing, there was damage to the nose gear.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, man, thanks for the call.
You're very welcome.
All right. If you hit something with the nose gear and you live to tell it, you've done well. The attitude of the aircraft must have been perfect for that collision, because it certainly would have the possibility of just tearing that nose section off. Would you agree with that?
I do, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I don't fly anymore, but I used to fly private aircraft, single engine. And, I used to say, and I still do, anybody can take off, but it's that landing.
Yeah.
You know, that's the crucial thing.
Yeah.
And the deal is that you've got to have, you not only have to be lined up on the runway, you've got to have the attitude, in other words, the angle at which that aircraft is flying through the sky. You got to have that attitude right, because if you don't, you are going to crash. And if you tip that nose down, you got a big, big problem. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, this is Eric from Atlanta again. I wanted to make one quick point regarding the Stephenville, Texas UFOs from back in January. Recently, MUFON was able to obtain radar data from the FAA, and it shows some targets, several of them, heading in the direction of the Crawford Ranch. And my thinking is that maybe someone in the FAA allowed the release of this information, because you would kind of think that if they didn't want this to be released, that they wouldn't have released it. And I wanted to get John's thoughts on that.
All right.
Thanks.
What do you think, John?
You know, that's tricky, that kind of question there, because we used to keep all the radar and the voice tapes for 30 days. And under the FOIA rules and regulations, anybody can request a copy of the voice tapes or the radar tapes. They may charge them for the work, but anybody can request that. And if they refuse it, it has to be because of a national security operation, so they would send it out anyway. And then if you looked at the tapes or the data and you came back and said, I think that this is what's right or what's wrong, the FAA can just say, we don't agree. And then that's the end of it. I mean, you're going to take them to court, you're going to prove them wrong. They're just going to say, we don't agree. We analyzed, when they looked at the Japanese, so they went to the West Coast, and they had the West Coast come up with the report. And when they published it in the paper, it said something that the FAA had analyzed the data and concluded that it was either ghosting targets or split beacons. It was equipment malfunction that everybody was seeing. What they forgot to say is that the Japanese pilots don't see ghost targets, and they don't see ring around, and they're reporting what they see. This was the first time that the FAA has gone on record saying we don't believe the pilot when he said this is what he saw.
Yeah, all three of them. We have to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with our conversation with John Callahan. We'll have time for maybe one more telephone call. The telephone number is there on your screen. All right, folks, we'll be back. Get it all. Become a member at KevinSmithShow.com. Thank you.
She's a pretty senorita sitting on my right. And when I glanced, she looked away. Her hair was raven and her eyes were dark with pain. But I drew her out and something changed. We took the vow to purity and truth. And we stood at the gateway of the sun with our love. We soared among the clouds. We had just begun a night in Machu Picchu, where the mountains touch the sky. Oh, a night in Machu Picchu, when the stars are in your eyes. Oh, she was afraid of a man in her past, running from the violence and the shame. And I took a vow to protect her to the last, as we stepped aboard that faded train. Our journey took us to an Incan resting place. She read a prayer for lovers past. We took the path to purity and truth. And we stood at the gateway of the sun with our love. We soared among the clouds. We had just begun a night in Machu Picchu, where the mountains touch the sky. With the stars are in your eyes. Oh, we held each other till the morning light and made a pledge never to part. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Her jilted lover found us in our warm embrace. The hate and anger filled his eyes. He held a gun pointed at my angel's face. I had to act or else she'd die. I grabbed the pistol, but the bullet pierced her heart.
Got iPod? Get K-Pods, the Kevin Smith Show podcast, and take Kevin with you everywhere. Subscribe today at kevinsmithshow.com.
All right, we are on final approach here. My guest is John Callahan, and let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Good evening, Kev. It's Tony in the Chicago Burbs.
Hello, Tony.
How are you doing tonight?
Outstanding, sir.
Great. I had a question for John. With all the different UFO reports and whatnot, and strictly from an AC point of view, how do they handle helo traffic, the helicopter traffic? Because you always hear of like black helicopters and escorts and this, that, and the other. I mean, is there a certain altitude where they, you know, monitor the helicopters, or just in general? I mean,
okay, let's let him respond.
Okay.
Well, the helicopters fall either under the military or, you know, private civilian. And if they're based on their altitude, if they're not going to get up into, well, they're not going to go above 18,000 feet normally, so they would be down in the tower's control area. And if the weather is VFR, where the pilot provides his own separation, and the only thing they would get is they would get the landing instructions on when to land, and they would get takeoff instructions to get them off the ground safely. Other than that, the flights are tracked, basically, but they're not controlled. They would handle them the same as if it was a Cessna going from your grass strip to my grass strip, and you're staying below the air traffic control zones.
All right, Tony, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I was just curious. Like you, we've talked about helicopters before, and it just kind of dawned on me. It's like, I wonder how they're actually handled.
Yeah. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
You know, if the military would have them on their radar, and the military would be controlling them, if you can accept that term. They would be telling them what to do, when to do it, and tracking their flight if it's a military. But if it's not, then it would fall, like if you're going from a casino to the airport when they provide that service, like a taxi service, and you're falling under the tower's control, and you're either VFR or you're under their control all the way.
Well, you know, now things may have changed because it's been a long time since I have flown, but I would fly, for instance, from Dallas, Texas, back over to Louisiana to a small municipal airstrip, and just the takeoff, clearance and instructions, ground instructions for where to taxi to, and then when to go. We informed them of our destination. We didn't hear anything from the controllers until we got close to the airspace of the Monroe Municipal Airport. It's a commercial airport. At that point, they would give us instructions about descending to a certain altitude and take a certain turn, and they would guide us around away from any landing or any traffic that was taking off. We had another 30 miles to go past that airport before we got to where we were going, but they would direct us around it if we were still on a dead line, dead straight line towards that airport. But unless we were approaching their airspace, we heard nothing from them, really.
Yeah, they were tracking you as a VFR advisory.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
Hi, yes. My name is James. I'm calling from upstate New York.
Okay, James, we can barely hear you, so speak up good and loud for us.
I'm calling from upstate New York. My question is, why do you think the government is so hell-bent on keeping all this secret? Like, everybody sees these things.
Well, I think they're keeping it secret because the technology bothers us. You know, in the United States, we walk around, we're the leaders of the world. Technology, you can't top us. And for them for the government to acknowledge that there is someone else out there that's maybe not of this earth that has a better technology or a higher technology than us, is very, very hard for our egos to come up with. And I think that's part of the problem. Until they can build a ship and move it from place to place like these other guys do, they're not going to be too happy with admitting that we're not number one.
I don't think that most people here in the United States would panic. But I do think that, if there was, a full disclosure from the government that, yeah, it's real, and by the way, we've had contact with them, and blah, 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 whatever the case may be. I don't think people here in the United States would panic so much. But I have lived in places where I am absolutely certain there would be panic. And I think one of the things that they are somewhat conscious of is not tipping the world over into sort of a global chaos. I'm not sure that would happen, but I do think that goes into their thought process. I do think that's part of... I've been in planning sessions, certainly not at that level and not on this topic, but I've been in planning sessions where it was unreal... the minutia that would come into the planning session that we had to consider. And so I am quite certain that the same sort of thing happens with these very high-level planning sessions, where are strategy meetings, where they think about disclosure. It's got to. I can't see any possibility that it would not come into their planning. What do you think?
No, I agree. And, you know, even going a step further, remember Reagan's Space Force policy or plan that he had and all the satellites that we control? There's supposedly a weapon on those satellites that's, I think the last I knew, but there was 9 satellites that had weapons that were pointing toward outer space. And Reagan went on in front of, I think it was the UN, and told them that that they had to consider people from outer space, you know, visiting us, and come up with a way to handle it, and that it would eventually unite the whole world when this eventually happened. So there is that mindset that's up at the higher level that says, you know, this is possible, and all the people may not buy it. The Catholic Church, a little while ago, came out and said that they have a big report on UFOs. They were going to make some of their data available. And, of course, you know, the England and Brazil and these other countries that published their UFO reports. It's just hard to believe you can have so many reports and have them all bogus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, like I said, you know, all these people may not be trained observers, but they have had eyes all their lives, and they know exactly what they're not looking at. You might not know what you're looking at, but you know if it's not an airplane. And, you know, even in the most backward countries, I think that would be the case. John, we're out of time, and I want to thank you for coming on the show and being with us tonight. It's been marvelous. I appreciate you being here.
Thanks. I had a good time.
All right, if you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment. And, ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap. John Callahan, my guest this evening, and it's time for me to tell you that my friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Stay tuned if you're on our TV channel for the SMN Spine Shake Theater. We'll be back tomorrow night. Until then, so long, everybody.